All right, so while Pastor Rossel is traipsing around Asia Minor, I have been commissioned to talk a little bit about the theory of just war as it's presented in sort of classical literature. So part of my day job, of course, is teaching classical literature. So this isn't a very onerous requirement. It was thought-provoking, and I will just say in order to get Pastor Rossel off the hook, if the talk goes south or introduces some crazy ideas, he just really wanted me to focus on the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid, and I'm bringing two more works into that because I think that they're critical to sort of understand kind of where we how we ended up where we are today. So I do teach the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and Beowulf still currently. So I have like 2-hour talks on each of these books that I'm decided not to try to bring in everything I know about the books. I don't technically teach the Iliad, and I used to teach Mort d'Arthur, but I don't anymore. So that's a little bit more in the past part of my brain. Probably not. Well, I mean, I do record the stuff that I'm doing now because we do classes on Teams for kids that have to learn asynchronously. So I do have those. All right, so I'm just going to sort of give you a notional idea of just war theory as it sort of has historically existed. So I am jumping Pastor Rossel's plan, which is to start in Genesis 1:1 and work forward. I'm also going to resist the temptation to bring a lot of New Testament passages, which actually are germane to the end of the talk, into the talk. So I'm going to let him do the Bible, okay? So if you say, well, it's Sunday school, Mike, you should have some Bible, okay, I'm intentionally letting him do the Bible part, okay? Does that make sense? So basically, things in just war theory is that you have to have a righteous reason. Now, we're going to be looking at really 4 different cultures, and I don't want to sound like a relativist here, but understand that righteousness is a relative term culturally, right? It's not a relative term biblically. You know, God's standard is God's standard. But in terms of what this culture thinks is righteous versus what this culture thinks is righteous, they can be very different things, and they can have no relationship. They can be antithetical to God's word and law. But what you'll find is that the people themselves will have a sense of what makes righteousness, okay? Proportionality is often involved. So this is the idea that you don't kill a mosquito with a bazooka. And so when we get to the Iliad, proportionality is actually a thing that is very prominent at the end of the book. So the idea that, you know, if you punch me in the nose, I punch you in the nose. If you chop off my arm, I chop off your arm. So it's kind of the lex talionis idea, an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. That idea is in most cultures. Okay, so the idea of proportionality. War is a last resort. Now, this is not uniform. And so you'll notice I don't have a Sumerian epic up here. And there is one. Gilgamesh is one. I don't have a Canaanite epic because there isn't one. But if I had one, believe me, last resort's not on their playlist. Okay, so a lot of cultures do not have this sort of last resort. But I will say that in all of these books, the idea that war is not your first response is in all of these books. Okay, so there's a great talk that we heard years ago at one of our last family advances. I think it was Ben House did the talk, and it was about the Punic Wars. Okay, and so, you know, remember the Carthaginians are really Phoenicians who are really Philistines. He talked about culturally the difference between Rome and Carthage and how horrible it would have been for the West if Carthage had won the Punic Wars, because that culture would become normative instead of the Roman culture. Now, I'm not quite as much of a Roman empire honk as my wife is, but I will say that the Romans had many advantages over the Carthaginians. Okay, and so the idea that all pagan cultures are basically the same is nonsense. And the early church was very aware that God had actually been sort of sowing into the Greeks and the Romans thinkers and things that actually got them closer to a Christian understanding. Okay, even the Reformers, John Calvin, his first book is on not 1 Corinthians, not, you know, Genesis, it's on the Roman philosopher Seneca, okay, because they viewed still, at the time of the Reformation, they viewed many of the Roman writers, especially, as sort of proto-Christian, okay? In other words, God's getting ready for the coming of Christ by sending Seneca to sort of seed the ground so that the Romans will more readily believe the gospel because this philosophy is much closer to Christianity than what was there previously. So the idea that, again, the pagans had this idea that, you know, war's not your first response, okay? Work through things. And then lastly, this is critical, the idea of a legitimate established authority. Now, again, this can be very relative, you know, who has the authority to tell us that we're going to go to war. But the idea that you just don't do this purely for personal motives. Now, the first book we look at, so-so on this one, okay? But this idea that you have a legitimate authority that is has the right and the responsibility to say it's time to go to war, okay? So, yes, sir. Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, and again, you know, I would say that the last election, you know, it was sort of a slap in the face of what's called the neocon establishment. And, you know, there are a lot of Republicans in the neocon establishment. There are a lot of Democrats as well. But, yeah, people that are more, you know, hawkish versus dovish. And I think, you know, one of the things that has been in Pastor Russell's mind to sort of prompt him to want to study this is, you know, remember where he grew up is heavily, heavily, you know, Mennonited. And so the Mennonites tend to be in this sort of pacifist camp. And so from his background, even though his dad was a DOD employee, you know, and Ben was, you know, working for SAIC, you know, there's this, you know, Christians don't support war, don't support governments that do war. There's that strong, and that's really a slice of the Christian church. And in many ways, it's logically attractive. I mean, it kind of makes sense, you know, in some ways. Here's some elements to think about, and now let's dive into the books. So our first book that we're going to look at is the Iliad. So for those of you that are familiar with the Iliad, bear with me while I explain the basic idea here. So the basic idea here is that a Greek prince, the prince of Lacedaemon, or what we would normally call Sparta, is a dude named Menelaus, and Menelaus's wife has been stolen from him by a shepherd boy named Paris or Alexandros, who happens to be one of the long lost princes of the city of Troy in Asia Minor, northwest Asia Minor, and Paris has a complicated history with his family. There's a curse on him that he will bring down his city and his family. But he, through kind of a beauty contest of the goddesses, wins this girl, and then flees back to his original home of Troy and says, "Mom, Dad, I'm here and I got a wife, and there's 10,000 Greek soldiers chasing me. Take me in, please." And so the natural rejoicing that, "Oh, son, we thought you were dead, and now you're alive, and oh, we have a beautiful daughter-in-law, that's not bad. And what? 2,000 what?" So the Greeks are going to chase. Now, the Greeks, remember, Greece is not a unified nation until the 1820s. Greece is a collection of little principalities. So the way I explain it to my kids, there would be a king of Valpy. There would be a king of Niceville. There would be a king of Crestview. There would be a king of Fort Walton Beach. Okay, so that's who these kings are, is they control maybe a little bit more people than Valpy, but not a lot more. And, you know, frequently the armies they bring with them are, you know, several hundred men. So basically all the men of fighting age go with the king or the prince to war. And so the Greeks camp on the beach, and the Greeks have essentially kind of an all-star team with some of their fighters. And the best fighter in the Mediterranean is a guy named Achilles. So this book is largely about Achilles and sort of his nature. And then on the Trojan side, Paris is a lover, not a fighter. So the fact that the capital of France is named for him should tell us a lot. The oldest brother in the family is a guy named Hector. So Hector is the responsible, dutiful heir to the throne that is going to lead the Trojan army against the Greeks. So you have sort of set up a complicated sort of deal where essentially we know, the reader knows, that Troy is doomed. Because this war took place roughly 1200 BC. Everybody knows that Troy lost. Hector is by far the most attractive, not physically, but as a character, most attractive character in the book. Okay, so the doomed enemy of the Greeks, remember this is a Greek book, the doomed enemy of the Greeks is the good guy. So that's like me writing a book in which Osama bin Laden is the good guy. Okay, morally, personality-wise, that's complicated, right? Achilles is simply a killing machine. He's like you know, when sharks roll their eyes right before they eat you. That's who Achilles is. He was born to kill. You know, he kills a man before breakfast just to, you know, freshen up, and then he's off to war. Now, the leader of the Greeks is a king named Agamemnon, who's Menelaus' older brother. Agamemnon is the worst person in the book. Okay, so he's the most repulsive, most venial, selfish, you know, idiotic. You name the vice, he's got it. So the Greeks aren't appealing. The Trojans are. Trojans are doomed. Now, the last little sort of kind of twist in it is Achilles has a prophecy over him that if he goes basically to fight, he will be killed. Okay, so the question for him is, do I do the thing I was made for and die in glory, or do I sit in my tent and, you know, have girlfriends and live till I'm an old man? Okay, so there's all kinds of complexities in the book. It's not a simple seventh grade boys, you know, battles, you know, and it has a lot of that. So there is an appeal to seventh grade boys, I'm just going to say. But the whole book has a lot of interesting things to think about. So in terms of the just cause, what we really have is a private matter that's escalated into a national thing. Menelaus has had his wife stolen. So instead of Menelaus showing up to the doors of Troy and asking King Priam, "Hey, tell your kid to give me my wife back," you know, he's raised an army to go do that. So there is a private vengeance element to this. But to the Greek mind, you know, wife stealing is a very bad thing. And so the Trojans shouldn't countenance this. The Trojans should not have accepted Paris back into the city with that girl. She's not his. Okay, so there is an element of righteousness that in the book, the Greeks, yeah, they're right to do this. However, the Trojans, in terms of their reason for fighting, have a just cause as well. They're being invaded. Okay, their country is being invaded. And so you have set up sort of these two, and this creates some moral ambiguity, right? Or ambiguity, I guess is the real word. You have a sympathy for people that are defending their homeland, and then you have sympathy for, you know, don't go stealing people's wives. Okay, so Homer balances this. The personal versus the collective, so the whole book is really about mostly Achilles not wanting to fight because Agamemnon has offended him repeatedly, and this last one is sort of, you know, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. So the Greeks can't win without Achilles fighting, okay? The Trojans can't win without Hector fighting. So if Achilles is sitting in his tents, the Trojans win, and they are winning. If Achilles is out there fighting, the Trojans don't stand a chance. And so the whole book kind of sets up to this final conflict between Achilles and Hector, and you know how it's going to end, okay? There's a lot of personal grievance going on here and a lot of personal reasons that I don't want to fight, okay? I talked about this idea of the defense of Troy. You know, nobody is going to say, you know, you don't fight for your homeland. Okay, that is assumed as a human basic. Okay, if you get attacked, you're fighting back. You're raising whatever force of arms you have, and you're going back to fight back. So this is a book that also basically looks at warfare as the sole occupation of free men. Okay, so that's an important idea as we go further down the line, is that, you know, there are free men and there are slaves. And free men can do other things in times of peace, but you're created to be a warrior. So the whole later Greek system of like the Athenians electing the general of the year, and it's, you know, it would be like somebody in here, you know, a school teacher getting elected, okay, you're the general. Now, if we go out to war and we lose, I'm toast, right? They don't fire their generals like we do. They execute them. There's a risk to being a bad general or a coward. But basically, the idea is that the free citizens, and you remember the free men are a minority in any of these Greek towns. The free men are the army, okay, and the officer corps. And then the slaves can go and fight, but you know, it's the free men that are the officer corps, if you will, and the brain trust of the military. Okay, so keep that in mind. Yes, sir.
Is there any thought to getting Paris up? Like, you know, when Joab was consolidating the kingdom,
yeah.
And there's a wise woman that comes out and says, why are you assaulting a city of Israel?
Yeah, no, there's no thought. And, you know, I think it all the time, like, why are you, because he's kind of a punk, you know, in my read of it, he's kind of a punk. Why don't you just do, you know, Priam was supposed to kill him when he was born, he didn't do the job, do it now, you know, get rid of this guy. And then, you know, part of it is also Hector is, you know, the guy any one of us would want to grow up to be. He is such a good dude. So I would say that, no, they don't really cross that. There's lots of things that I would like them to think about that they don't in the book. Yes, ma'am? Oh, yeah. No. She's not popular at all. All right. I'm going to scooch on to the Odyssey. So the Odyssey is, you know, the sequel to the Iliad, but it's really a very, very almost completely different book other than being set with sort of a lot of the same characters and same time period. So the Odyssey is about one of the Greek heroes going home. And so, you know, the Trojan War lasted 10 years. So he's gone for 10 years, and then it takes him about 10 years to get home. And the problem is that everybody is presuming in the days before cell phones that he's dead because he has written home. And therefore, his very, very attractive, eligible, now eligible wife is in high demand from the generation of young men that were too young to go to war. So these would be guys that were probably in their early 30s. She's probably not much older than them. You know, I'm guessing late 30s perhaps, because she'd just gotten married when Odysseus left. So she's probably 38, and these guys are, you know, 33, 32. And it's all the young bucks of the surrounding islands. And so there's 100 of them that have kind of come to her palace and are camped out waiting for her to make a choice. Okay, so there is an egregious violation of one of the two most important Greek kind of ethical things. So the Greeks have they have a religion in the sense that they have gods that they sacrifice to. None of the Greek gods are people you want to spend 5 minutes with, because they'll all, you know, just imagine the most temperamental, arbitrary, whimsical person you've ever met, and now give them the power to shoot laser beams through you and kill you. Okay, that's the Greek gods. Okay, they're horrible people, and so other than Athena in the Odyssey, so if they take your side, you know, you got an advantage. But for the most part, they're just they get offended with you and they try to kill you. So it's not worship and adoration like we would think in a Christian sense. Okay, ethically, you know, the Greeks are pretty sorry. The hero of this book, Odysseus, is probably the biggest liar in the history of literature. And he's terrific at it. He lies to his own dad at the end of the book just for fun, just to, you know, hey, Dad, I still got it. Ethically, not a lot to see here. However, they have two big rules. The first big rule is you are always hospitable to strangers, because it could be one of those vindictive gods in disguise. And if you treat, you know, Eric shows up to me and he's got that white beard and hair, I should, you know, that should be a clue, right? He could be important. But I treat him like trash because I don't know him, and he turns out to be a Greek god, you know, I now get, you know, a lightning bolt through me. Okay, so you treat strangers. And then related to this is the idea of hospitality, that you don't abuse this. Okay, so there's an abuse of hospitality that also. So it's a gift-giving culture, and like many cultures that are gift-giving cultures, you know, so I have a birthday party, you're not giving me presents, I'm giving you presents for coming and being my friend. Okay, and the more important a person is, the more I shower gifts on you. Okay, so that idea of largesse is what we call that. I guess that's an English word. It's a French word, too. Largesse is the idea that I show you how important I am by, A, how big of a house I got, and, B, how many good things you get because you know me and I'm generous. Okay, I've got it to give away. It doesn't matter to me. Okay, so it's not a material thing at all. These suitors have been at the house for 3 years. They're eating poor Penelope out of house and home. And they're riotous, and they're rude, and they're sleeping with the maids. They're bad people, okay? So they've committed an offense, okay? So you've got a wife-stealing issue here, perhaps. But, you know, who can blame people for thinking that Odysseus is probably dead? But they don't have a death certificate, so hold on. And then they're disrupting the social order, okay, they are. And there is a sort of a greatest generation kind of dimension to this too. All the fellows that went off the Trojan War, that's the Greeks' greatest generation. So here are the soft baby boomers who've never had to go to war, you know, living it up. They think they're tough guys. They don't have a clue, okay? They're not the guys that went and defeated Troy. So that's all going on in the Odyssey. And so Odysseus is basically fighting to get home, and then he is seeking how to, you know, 1 versus 108, win a battle that's, humanly speaking, impossible to win. But, you know, can he figure out how to do it because he's so clever? So this idea of this is a personal vengeance issue, but it is also setting the social order back where it ought to be. Okay, so there's a collective community dimension to this. In other words, all of society goes to heck in a handbasket if people are going to act like this. So you need to settle their hash, as it were. The idea that the gods who interfere just ridiculously in all three of the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid, the gods take sides, you know, therefore one side or the other, and they're constantly intervening, okay? So the idea that the gods care about our conflicts and our dealings, that's a very real idea. So there's no sort of, you know, kind of a stoic idea that, you know, here's the deistic notion of God as the clockmaker and he just winds it up and then it goes. These are gods that are very, very interested in what happens. Okay, so they have that. And then xenia is their word for that hospitality code that kind of has two dimensions to it. So there are ethical violations here that are significant. So Odysseus obviously gets home. He cleans the suitors out. Is reunited with his wife. The book is interesting because there are a couple female characters in the Iliad. There are lots of female characters in the Odyssey, and they are all very, very complicated. And to a one, they're all smarter than any man in the room. And remember, in Greek culture, women were basically still property. Okay, so for a book, you know, roughly now, you know, 2,800 years old, to have the idea that women are people, okay, you know, that's completely anti-cultural. So it's an interesting book in a lot of ways, but this idea of there is a justice that's served by violence, okay? And so this doesn't really have, it's got the Trojan War as a background, it doesn't really have a war in it, but there are ideas that relate to this idea of, you know, what a man should do with his time. So Odysseus, one final note, he's a guy that would rather outsmart you and rob you than kill you, okay, than fight you. He's a good fighter, and he kills plenty of people in this book, especially the 108 at the end, but he takes a personal satisfaction at being able to outsmart you. It's easier to kill you, so it's a harder challenge for me to trick you into giving me all your stuff. Okay, so there's that element too. All right, so now we're going to move to, I think, what's probably the most important book in the talk today, and that's the Aeneid. And so the Aeneid is a book that's written by a guy named Virgil, sort of on command from Caesar Augustus. Okay, so they're friends. Virgil's a scholar. Augustus is, you know, the first Roman emperor. And he basically wants a founding myth written. So the Iliad and the Odyssey served with a couple of other books, like Ovid's Metamorphoses, as kind of the Greek Bibles. Right, they didn't have a Bible. We got the only Bible. This is going to be the Roman Bible, okay? And so the Romans, I'm not sure Homer knew about the Bible. Virgil knows about the Bible because there are Jews in Rome with Bibles, so he knows about the Bible, at least the Old Testament. And so Augustus wants a book that sort of gives them who we are, where we came from, what our national calling is. So this is, at one level, this is a work of, you know, intentional political propaganda, right? So there's a lot of criticism of the Aeneid because, you know, lefties don't like political propaganda unless they're writing it. But there's also the idea of why Rome? What what are we here for? You know, what's our fate? And so this idea, first of all, that Aeneas, he's married to a daughter of Priam and Hecuba in Troy, so he's a Trojan prince. He's not blood. He's married in. And then at the fall of Troy, he's going to flee, and he's going to lead a band of Trojan refugees throughout the Mediterranean, and they're going to go found Rome, basically, before Romulus and Remus. They're going to land and populate, you know, provide a citizenry. And so remember in the Greek books, the Trojans are very noble people, and like they're to be admired. The Romans are choosing the Trojans out of those two books to be their founders, not the Greeks. They borrowed ferociously from the Greeks, but they really had a lot of criticisms of Greek ways. In a lot of ways, it's like kind of Westerners in the U.S. versus Easterners. Okay, Westerners are tough, independent, resolute. You know, I can go land in the wilderness and you'll come back and find a fort and a house and, you know, a family. Easterners are soft, sissified, you know, dandified. That's kind of the Western Med versus Eastern Med in this time period idea is, you know, we conquered them because they're sissies, and not to put too blunt a point on it, homos. You know, that's what you get. Okay, so again, all of that's going on in this is the background for this book. Okay, so this idea that the fates have decreed that Rome is going to be founded and is going to sort of fulfill this imperial destiny, and Aeneas is in many ways the unwilling, unlikely guy to make this happen. Okay, so Aeneas's vibe is he's a great warrior, but he left his heart in Troy. Okay, so he's escaping Troy. I think that's actually the picture I got up there, is that's his wife there in front. He's got his dad back. It's hard to see in that picture. His son is following after. And essentially, he's escaping with his family. His wife gets killed in the escape, so she doesn't make it. And he gets his dad out. So, you know, kind of the Roman way is choose your father over your wife. So that's not very biblical. But that's the Roman way. They're going to escape, but he's a guy that's walking around with a hole in his chest about that big the rest of the book. Okay, he's a shattered, emotionally shattered guy. So he's sort of the emblematic figure of I'm going to go do what is right. I'm going to go do my duty. I'm not going to take really any joy in it, you know, because my life is over. Okay, so he's got that kind of dimension to him. He's also a guy that, although he's a good fighter, he hates war. I mean, hates it. Okay, so this is a Roman book, right? We think of the Romans as, you know, you got these massive armies and you're subjugating all these people. You know, their national myth has a guy that's a good fighter but doesn't really want to be a soldier. Okay, he'd rather sit in his house and, you know, raise his veggies. So Aeneas is going to go on to do this. Aeneas is extremely pious. So Achilles is not quite the god mocker that Diomedes is, but he's close-ish. Odysseus, you know, again, Athena is his bud, so he'll take Athena. You know, he dog cusses Poseidon to his face, okay? So he's not pious at all, really. So this guy is actually pious, okay? He reveres the gods. And then, you know, remember that the Romans change, you know, they adopt most of the Greek system, but they do change it substantially in the sense that they tone down all of the morally questionable stuff because the Romans have morals after a fashion. Okay, they have a code of honor, a code of duty, a code of behavior. They're not It's not Christian, but it's way closer to being Christian than the Greeks were, okay? And so there's a reason, I think, that God chooses to use the time of the Roman Empire for Christ to come, because, A, they've, you know, built roads out everywhere, so evangelists are going to be able to go all throughout Europe and North Africa and the Near East. But also, you know, the Romans have sort of set the tone for gods who care about how you act. Okay, the Greeks had two rules, and after that, it's anything goes. So I do think that there's a dimension there. But the idea of a noble man who fears the gods, who you know, will fight because he has to, and so even though in this book he's the invader, okay, the guy that he's fighting, his primary adversary in the Aeneid is a fellow named Turnus. Turnus is like Achilles. He's an animal. Okay, and in the book, it's funny, Virgil compares him to about 40 different animals in his description. So Turnus is animalistic. Okay, Aeneas is a man, a human. Okay, so there's a big difference in the way that the heroes kind of come across. So Aeneas is much more Hector than he is Achilles. Okay, and he's got zero Odysseus except for the travel part. All right, so now I'm going to jump to two Christian books. Okay, so, yes, sir? Do the Greeks, they had amphitheaters. Yeah, no, the Romans are bloodthirsty. Yeah, they're, I'm not saying that they're, you know, St. Francis or Mother Teresa. But there is a difference. There's a real difference in them the Greeks. All right, so I'm going to jump forward about 500 years to the northern central part of Europe. So this is the Danish peninsula of Jutland and sort of southern Sweden and kind of the environs around. And so there is this book doesn't get written down until about 800 AD, but it's written down by an English monk sort of right as English is being re-Christianized in the time of the Heptarchy. But it's set in a place that scholars didn't think had any Christianity in it in 500 AD. And so you guys know when the Romans fled, they'd been all the way up to the Scottish border. They flee south. They leave lots of Christians in the places that they flee. They were largely Christian by the time that they have to flee and defend Rome from the barbarians. But then, you know, basically these barbarians kind of sweep across northern Europe. Some of those barbarians had been evangelized, but they don't end up in northern Europe. The ones that have been evangelized end up in southern Europe, and they're Arians, which is a problem. The ones that come into northern Europe are basically pagan. And so these Christians are now forced to re-evangelize. So, you know, we sing the Lorica. St. Patrick is kind of in this time period, but he goes, you know, west to Ireland. But St. Boniface comes down. So a lot of these English monks come down back into northern Europe to re-evangelize. So based on what scholars historically think, they say there were no Christian warriors in Jutland in 500 AD. However, you know, this is an old story. The English monk didn't make the story up. People just sort of accuse him of Christianizing it. Now, J.R.R. Tolkien, who was a Beowulf scholar, and if you read The Hobbit, there's a lot of Beowulf in The Hobbit. Tolkien basically writes a brilliant, you know, article-length explanation that if the Christianity is not in the original poem, that the poem falls to pieces. Okay, so without the Christianity, there is no Beowulf. So that's an interesting, if you're interested in Beowulf, that's an interesting article to read. So basically, Beowulf is kind of a high at the beginning of the book. So he's living in Sweden. He comes down to Jutland, Denmark, and they're having trouble with a monster. And so he's going to basically rid this Christian community of this demonic terrorist. And the poem makes it clear that Grendel's the monster's name, that he's a descendant of Cain. So when Cain gets banished and has kids, they turn into monsters and ogres. Grendel's one of them. Okay, so there's a theological dimension to the evil character right off the bat. Beowulf basically fights three monsters here. He fights Grendel, Grendel's mother, and then a dragon. And so all three of them have a theological dimension to them. So he's going to come down, protect this incipient Christian community. And the poem says that this Danish community has just recently converted to Christianity. So in other words, there are people alive there who worship the old gods. And when Grendel is destroying, ravaging their community, they say, aha, and this happened back in Rome. The old gods are mad at us for going over to the new god, and they're punishing us. We need to go back to the old gods. Okay, Augustine's City of God is written for the exact same reason. Rome is being attacked and defeated, and people are saying, oh, it's because we went to this new god. If we go back to the old gods, we'll be okay. Okay, so it's the same sort of dimension going on. It's a recently converted community. So Beowulf comes in. He kills Grendel. He kills Grendel's mother. So these are one-on-one. This isn't warfare. But the background of the book is this tribal mix of tribes coming in and invading other tribes. And so it's this existential crisis that, you know, you have all these people movements and, you know, we're all getting wiped out. And so will the poor Christians survive the attack of these pagan, which when the poem's written down in England in 800, remember they were dealing with Viking invasions at that time in England. And so the book was, it's interesting, technically these are kind of Vikings because they're Scandinavian, but they're Christian and they're defending against the invading hordes, right? And so the third part of the book, Beowulf's been king for 50 years, a dragon comes, and it's exactly the same smog, and somebody steals, and now the dragon's flying around, you know, lighting up the towns. So that's all direct, you know, that part of The Hobbit's all directly from Beowulf. But basically, at the end of the book, he's going to go to war to protect his people against the dragon. He's also motivated by the glory, so this goes back to the previous three books, and he's motivated by the gold, okay, and that goes back to the previous three books as well. Okay, so he's got some ambiguous motivation. So he goes, fights a dragon, kills a dragon, but he's killed too. So his wound is in his neck, not his heel, but he does kill the dragon's head. Okay, so there's a lot of biblical imagery in the whole poem. There is, when he kills Grendel's mom, there is a literal descent into Hades. He has to go down for hours and hours and hours to kill her and then come back up. There is actually a descendant to Hades and a resurrection in both the Odyssey and the Aeneid. So those guys don't know what they're playing with probably, but that motif is there. The death of the hero and the resurrection and apotheosis of the hero is there. So the heroic code in this book is you know, rampant. So this idea that free men are warriors first, that's your number one calling and duty. That's why God made you. And there's rules to that. There's rules, loyalty rules, generosity rules, all kinds of rules to being a fighter and a hero. And this idea that, you know, you're called to now battle not just human foes, but supernatural ones. Okay, so there's definitely a Christian dimension to this. Okay, so my last picture is of St. Michael killing a dragon, right? Okay, this is, I mean, Grendel's not the dragon, the dragon's the dragon, but you know, Grendel kills a dragon. Okay, so this is replete with biblical imagery, but the idea of a Christian warrior is the thing you got to have number one in your head. Okay, this is a Christian whose number one job is to be a brave warrior. All right, last book we're going to look at is the Mort d'Arthur. So this is the king first real King Arthur epic. There are older older tales about the Knights of the Round Table before this book is written, but Thomas Malory writes this book while in jail in the early 1400s. And basically, he's going to tell the first real telling of sort of this Christian king, early Christian king in England. So there really is a king, Arthur. He's probably they think they found his grave. It's kind of over towards Wales or in Wales or Cornwall, basically, King Alfred the Great is the one that kind of, in real life, unifies England as a Christian king and then fights off the Vikings, right? He's the guy. But this is before that, and it's sort of a unification story. And basically, we're pretty familiar with this story, the Knights of the Round Table. And the thing that I kind of want to look at here is the development of this sort of hero's code, this code of conduct for warriors. Okay, so the whole chivalric code is basically a rule book about how a warrior, okay, so again, a free man, and in this case now you're a noble, not a peasant, but peasants aren't technically free because they're attached to land. So in the feudal system, if you're a free man, this is who you are. You're a warrior. But there are all kinds of rules. And so the moral dimension to this, which I think begins really with Aeneas, certainly is present in Beowulf, I think is fully developed here, is that warriors have rules. And their swords may never be used for wickedness or unjustness or an unjust cause. Okay, so there is a tremendous, and you think of the violence of the Middle Ages, right? Okay, this book was designed to sort of put an ideal out there and hold these guys that could really, terrorize people if they wanted to a standard of godliness. And so there's personal piety, there's public piety, there's, what you can and can't do with your power, your weapons. And that is incredibly important for sort of the development in the West of this idea of the Christian warrior. Okay? So the book is also very interesting because you have this ideal in the chivalric system, and this book tells you that every ideal. So, we use Camelot like this idea. Remember John F. Kennedy's, had Camelot. It was this perfect sort of time. We use Camelot that way today, that word today, for this sort of idealized, perfect, harmonious, utopian almost community. But what Mallory's saying is that because of human sin, the fallenness of man, there's always a fox in the hen house. Okay, so one of the foxes in the hen house, of course, is Sir Lancelot, Arthur's best friend, who carries on an affair with Guinevere. And so in the chivalric code, you were permitted to take a woman you were not married to and basically put her on the pedestal and idealize her and spend all of your time, complimenting her, sending her presents, writing poems in her honor instead of your wife. Okay, so that is a flaw in the system. Okay. Women are precious flowers. I agree with the medievals on that. But, God gives you a flower. He doesn't give you somebody else's flower. Okay, so it kind of almost goes back to the Iliad, this idea of another man's wife, right? So there's a flaw there. There's obviously a flaw with when they finally go out to pursue the Holy Grail. The deal with the Grail is if you are harboring any inner sin in your heart or your life, hidden sin, you pursuing the Grail is going to reveal that. So Galahad's the only guy that's actually the same on the inside as he is on the outside. All these guys on the outside are good men, okay, but none of them are good men all the way to the inside. So that's such a profound biblical idea that, you know, am I really going to survive the scrutiny or the attacks of the enemy if I'm harboring something on my insides? You know, I'm keeping my little private sin, my precious. So that's the point of the whole Holy Grail thing, is that, you know, you better check out your insides before you go on one of these grand quests. And then there's the last little piece of sort of the fall of Camelot is family. So Guinevere is his wife, but he's got family issues. Arthur's own birth is very suspect, and then he's got family that drag him down. So there's a piece to this. The way I characterize it is, you know, if you're going to pursue Christ, there will be family members you may be giving up. Okay, and so Jesus says that, right? He says, you know, you got to leave your father and your mother and come after me. We have family members that will drag us to hell if they get the chance, right? So you can't give into that. You got to choose God over them. And there's this moral ambiguity here. So certainly this book, and I'm kind of over time, I'll stop here, you know, has the highest version of what just war for goodness and God can be, but it also, you know, it's not idealized. And that's the thing that I want to kind of point out, is that all of these books have a huge ringing bell on kind of the moral ambiguity of the warrior and the fact that, you know, being a professional killer has consequences to your insides. Okay, which, again, you know, we live in a special forces community. You know, we know what happens to some of these guys, you know, who've been deployed 15, 18 times. You know, we know what it does to their insides. Okay? And not even talking the PTSD part, just the things you've seen, the things you've had to do, we know what it does. So I think that's in here too. So I'm kind of over time. Anybody have any thoughts or questions? Yes, sir.